inspired by Mark Twain, let's save some ants. This is David and I'm here with
John.
And our aim is to discuss some topics, and no ants will be injured in the production of these discussions.
Welcome to Little Shakers.
This video is quite personal. All the videos are personal because they are a view that is sometimes shared with small nuances and differences between myself and my collaborator, my brother John.
Yeah.
But we try to give a perspective on things that is not necessarily the mainstream narrative, the popular version of events, but is nevertheless true. And so what I want to talk about now is immigration, illegal immigration. And how I want to start is this. It used to be illegal in this country to be gay, to be homosexual. Illegal. You could go to prison for it. Bear that in mind, that any law created by a human being can be reviewed, improved, or even abolished completely, repealed. Any law. So laws are only as good as the group of people who sat together to write up that law, to envisage that law, and to put that law into practice.
Yeah, I'm with you so far.
Now, in the Second World War, there were horrendous crimes arguably against humanity committed. And so our country, just after the war, a staunch advocate of this law about asylum was Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister who got us through arguably as leadership. If you believe in the leadership principle, he helped us through the Second World War with wonderful leadership. Speeches, etc., allocation of resources. So he was, in a survey that was done about 10 years ago, he was found to be the greatest Briton, according to the population that voted in this survey.
Well, we're on the subject of the greatest Briton. This is William here. What about Alexander Fleming, whose discovery of penicillin saved more lives than anybody, arguably, in the history of humankind?
Yeah, this is Mark here. I would say that's a very worthwhile contribution, a great idea.
Strangely enough, I voted for Isambard Kingdom Brunel. What an entrepreneur he was. A BBC Pearl, I believe, so naturally it was swayed towards the left. By the way, scrap the license fee. Move on.
It's an interesting, going back to what you were talking about, it's an interesting point that you make about, laws, because, I believe in the 1920s, women weren't allowed to vote, and only about 50 years before that, men, unless they had property, weren't allowed to vote. But yes, my personal opinion, you're right, Winston Churchill was a Great Briton, so yes, I agree with that.
And therefore, he might be somebody who's worth dismissing completely. Yeah, he might. But he might be somebody on certain issues that might be worth listening to. And after the war, for humanitarian grounds, again, with the international community, he signed laws that allowed for people to claim asylum if they were being mistreated in the country due to religion, sexuality, and so on and so on, political beliefs, so that they could seek asylum elsewhere. And that we, because of what had happened to the Jewish people, particularly in the Second World War, although the Holocaust wasn't confined only to Jewish people, it was also enacted against so-called gypsies, who were called gypsies at the time, disabled people, and people who were referred to as sexual deviants. So it was a wide group of people that were infringed upon and killed during that period, but massively Jewish people. And so the policies were enacted that would make it so that this would never happen again. And the particular this that would never happen again that these laws were focused on was that people would not be turned away who were trying to escape that level of persecution or those particular types of persecution. And so we, along with the international community, said, never again. Now, in recent times, laws have been enacted in our country that have made it illegal. There's no legal routes for people to claim asylum in this country. Moreover, people who do come here illegally, because don't forget, everybody who tries to claim asylum, no matter how legitimate their claim for asylum is categorised as illegal. So there's no legal route. So they risk it anyway. So they commit a crime, arguably. Like those people who escaped on the Kinder transport, like those people that Oskar Schindler helped, if the laws that were in place then, were in place then, those people would be treated as illegals. So we must be very careful what we wish for. Now, to further make things complicated, our government puts them up in hotels. Not in the Nightingale hospitals that they had for a short while. Oh, definitely not. Not in derelict mills and industrial complexes that could be converted. Oh, no. They put into hotels. So there's some sort of political shenanigans going on here. So how did this start? How did this idea of using people from other countries as political pawns, how did it start? So after the war, Great Britain's economy was in tatters. We were in rationing until around 1957, after the war. Why? This is the Second World War that I'm referring to. Because we won. Now, other countries that were occupied or lost, outright lost in the Second World War, gained monies as aid to rebuild. We didn't, because we won. So our economy is crumbling. Our economy is faltering. Don't forget we'd had the 1914-18 war just a generation before. The 1939 to 1945 Second World War, where we defeated tyranny and fascism and a dictatorship in favour of liberal democracy.
1939 to 45, this is Mike here. In our history books, it's recorded as 1941 to 1945. Yeah, well, Alfred, she was a bit late to the party from what my dad tells me, anyway, better late than never, I always think. Well, I mean, we did make a substantial contribution to the war effort. I think your John Wayne did a fantastic job. Well, there's no need to be sarcastic.
So to make that win come to reality, first off, we had to borrow a load of money from the United States of America, which took until 1995 to be paid off. Russia, by the way, just as an aside, they're an enemy at the moment, but Russia at the time joined in the Second World War as an ally on our side for free. This is how treacherous the political landscape can be. And so, after the war, a decision was made by the management of this country, in other words, the government and the business community of the day, to revitalise the economy. Well, they couldn't wait for the population to breed new workers as fast as possible. I mean, they'd have to be at least, back in those days, about 15 to start work. So they couldn't wait 15 years to replenish the workforce after two world wars in two generations. So what did they do? They put out a call, particularly to the Commonwealth, inviting people to come here, inviting people to work here in our textile industries, on our transport system, in the hospitals, any jobs that needed doing in the steel industry. We had industries then. And those industries needed to be revitalized, needed to be moved from wartime production into more standard production. The car industry, I don't know whether I already said that. So what's the answer? Well, the workforce here were in a position to leave a job on a Friday and start another job on a Monday. So they had power and influence over their own wages. They could go for a pound an hour more. Probably back in those days, a few shillings an hour. But it'd add up and it'd make a significant difference.
Freddie, can I just chip in at this point?
you know, a lot of people, they'd fought a war and sacrificed and lost relatives, you know, the fathers and brothers and so on, and you know, in that war. And they wanted to see the fact that they'd had a victory. It wasn't that people, you know, who objected to this were sort of racist or anything like that. It's just that it seemed that the victory, which should have led to prosperity, were being taken away from people. And you know, I thought, you know, my father told me that that's how he felt, you know.
Yes, well, George, naturally, the economy took precedence. Our businesses needed to be strong, and of course this gave rise to the unions, who became drunk with power and tried to hold us all to ransom, you know, and so therefore something had to be done.
Well, George, I don't think that's very fair. My uncle was a member of the union, and all he wanted was a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. And what a lot of people forget is that if you go on strike, you'll lose your pay. And I mean, a lot of people accuse us of, if we did strike, and wanting to go to the FA Cup, but that's not true. But anyway, that's my recollection of the situation. And besides, what other method did we have to negotiate?
So industry needed to be competitive. It needed to bring in a willing workforce. So naturally, this spread the net. And the first places they spread the net was in the Commonwealth, the West Indies, India, Pakistan, amongst other places. And people came. People came for a better life. I'm not going to sugarcoat this. The truth is they came for a better life. Now, I have certain recollections passed down from my father, John's father, who talked about the people he remembered seeing, the newsreels, as it happened, or certainly within a few days, and the smiling faces of the people that were coming here. They came here as allies. They came here for a better life. And he pointed out a factor which is so trivial but so significant. They were wearing overcoats, and yet they'd come from incredibly warm places in comparison. Well, where had they got the overcoats from? They'd probably been issued, probably been given a voucher, maybe even a loan, and had to pay them off. But nevertheless, they were wearing big smiles because they were coming to do a good thing, and they were wearing overcoats. But the British public weren't told that they were here to save the economy. I think, this is purely my thought process, they weren't told because that would jeopardise our thought as the so-called indigenous population that we had had a win. Because in a way, that win was going to be taken away from us because the wage bill were going to be pushed down. There was going to be competition for jobs now, whereas there was almost no competition for jobs immediately after the war. The government of the day wouldn't want to tell us that, and so therefore they didn't. And so therefore there was antagonism towards these people that came from abroad. But if the government had told the truth and said, look, it's going to be better for everyone if the economy is revitalised, these guys are coming as allies, are coming as our friends, they're part of the Commonwealth, they've got the same king or queen by then. Elizabeth II would have been on the throne by then, from 1953 anyway. Then the reaction might have been different. And we have a situation now where there's antagonism towards people coming from abroad, still to this day because of it, because it's become the cultural norm to be antagonistic towards people that come from abroad. Now, people say they should stay in the first safe country that they come to, but there wasn't anything in whatever it's called, the Geneva Accords or the international, there's nothing in the international law that says that people have got to do that, nothing at all. And so that's the worldwide understanding of what the asylum laws are.
Oh, I don't want to be unkind or anything, but, you know, my understanding was that people should, you know, if they're fleeing persecution, take safe harbour in the first country they arrive in. Is that not a law then at all? Because I was under a very strong impression that it was.
I think we've found in recent times, this is Mike, I think we found in recent times that, yes, the law has changed, but if somebody has a genuine, as David says, if someone has a genuine claim for asylum, they have the right to join family members and so on in whichever country. And a lot of people's first language is English. They don't speak French or German. And perhaps because England is, or Britain, Great Britain really, has had a fairly progressive attitude to immigration, they may already have family members in the UK or an established community where they feel completely safe. Oh, well, yes, I can see that.
Well, I don't know, it's all a bit confusing. I've heard a lot of people say that half an hour, and I thought it was true. So it's a bit of a complex issue, I think.
Now, again, you're probably thinking, hang on a minute, there are people that come fraudulently. Well, of course. There are people that do everything that you can think of fraudulently. And those people then need to be interviewed, processed, and separated from people who are genuinely asylum seekers. I don't deny that. But to make all asylum seeking illegal, when you consider the history that's gone before, and you consider the reasoning why the international laws were in place to allow for legitimate asylum seeking, it's an affront to the memory of us winning the Second World War, and it's an affront to the memory of the greatest, so-called greatest Britain of all, to remove those laws. And we have just finished a week, to put this into context, where an MP, a black lady MP, Diane Abbott, has been mentioned, not allowed to speak in Parliament about a situation that arose where a Tory donor mentioned that he was so annoyed with her that she should be shot, and it's become public. And yet our government hasn't bothered to call it out for what it is. So our culture has changed from the country that we were when Winston Churchill was alive to a country that won't stand up against the tyranny of calling somebody out and their entire race as annoying people because of one. Again, I ask you, is that what we signed up for? Because as far as I'm concerned, it's not. Yes, maybe we should have a points-based system and that immigration should be monitored and controlled to a certain extent. Of course. Of course. But also people talk about overseas aid. Nobody asks what we get in return for the overseas aid. Do people genuinely think that we're a philanthropic country that gives overseas aid for nothing?
Hello, this is Christopher. Can I just say that there's a quotation in an episode of Star Trek. Well, basically it's gangsters, but one of the characters says, nobody does nothing unless he does it for himself. And Mr. Spock says, you are employing a double negative, sir. But what he means is that people don't do things, I think you say, altruistically, because there's got to be something in it. And when government has responsibility to make the best use of our tax monies, or did then, they must do it for some sort of other reason.
Well, that's Star Trek. That's a great pro, Mike, here, Christopher. Star Trek was a great program at its day, but, I mean, you're talking about something that's over 50 years old.
Yeah, but human nature doesn't change, does it?
Well, that's a good point.
One of the fringe benefits of overseas aid is that countries that are in difficulties are more prosperous than they might be, therefore less of their people get up and leave to try to come to what they believe is the more comfortable lifestyle that is lived within Europe. So there is a payment, even if we don't know what that payment looks like. There's a common sense payment, notwithstanding the fact that we probably get cheap clothing and such and like from these countries as part of the deal. Since our manufacturing industry is massively reduced, surely common sense suggests that there's a great likelihood, isn't it?
Well, George, oddly enough, you might not expect me to say this, but there's no profit in everyone being poor.
So think about these prejudices. Think about the society that you want to live in. Do you want to live in a country that, if this was 1940, would turn away the people fleeing what was happening in Europe? I don't.
Well, you know, Fred, I'm always happy to learn, and that's been quite useful.
William here, best to keep an open mind, because things change, laws change, people change. I know you said human nature's a constant, Chris, but we all change.
Well, I'm glad I took part, really, because Arthur here, I'm glad I took part because it's always always learn something new.
Keep smiling!